Greetings, comrades. This is Poet Radio, October 2019. I'm Chris Funkhauser, host of the program, and as you may be aware, WGXC is currently ensconced in its fall fundraiser, in which our goal is to add 50 more sustaining monthly supporters to the station's highly valued roster of sustaining supporters. And you can certainly call in a one-time donation, but what really works better is to have sustaining monthly supporters who spread their donations out over the course of a year. All of this can be easily set up via wgxc.org/donate. Listener support is vital to the station's survival. We would be unable to keep this great station going without you. So if you appreciate and enjoy what you hear at WGXC, please consider offering your sustaining support via the website or by calling in by phone at 518-697-7400. As usual, I have scripted a special fundraising drive program. This time around, I'll be presenting recordings I made of local artist and scholar Peter Lamborn Wilson reading from his new book, Hoodoo Metaphysics, published by Bear Puff earlier this year. Specifically, you will hear, divided up into three segments, a section of the book titled Poetown, which will be followed by an interview with the author. So stay tuned, enjoy the poetry, and please go online and show us your support via wgxc.org/donate.
All right, this is part three of my new book, Hoodoo Metaphysics, that I did with Tamara Gonzalez. And this section is called Poetown, P-O, Poetown, which is a pun on Poughkeepsie and also poetry. You know how Ed Sanders calls everything Poe this and Poe that.
Poe this.
Yeah. So it's Poughkeepsie, but it's also poetry. I call this a small epic. It's, as you'll see, it has certain epic qualities. Poetown, Part 1, An Architectural Guide. After the world has come to an end, you could do worse than Poughkeepsie. More grays and browns than a wadi in Maghreb, their tessellations enhanced by a thoughtful mist, graded to a Parnassian ombritude, or little by little, el cuidad invisible, city with a beard. Will heaven be efficient? They chortled. Well then, neither shall we. There goes Whistler's mother, and there she goes again in slow-mo, all day wet as candlelight in the opera house of Sherds, like a horror story without a plot. Ghosts of Wales, spooks the color of post-solstice asphalt. REM dream with open eyes, cataracted round the lens and haloed with spume. How Episcopalian the dead trees, lithographed against rotten steel, more aqueous than pearls, but shallower. Like 2.5 dimensions, or daguerreotypes, faded by too much melancholic fingering. Your Burke, your Joseph de Maistre, your René Guénon, your Yeats and Lovecraft, but not a single ship to be seen. Color of an old man's tears, and just as meaningless. Part 2, Eco-Ectoplasm. You who grew up there would find it haunted by former sheaths, oral peelings, psychic cocoons, could honor its gothic melancholic terminal collapse, life in the ruins. Picturesque Charlie is not the same as beautiful. Someone who remembers how bad the food was in 1953. Plus the usual pool halls, draw degenerate bankrupts and pale Dutch inverts into some sad voodoo of distorted faces and minor moral monsters. Boring, really, when you get to know them, but far more appealing than the police. Regional hints of mottled silver, chandeliers glimpsed through opaque panes, where insurance hacks and ambulance chasers have taken over some Georgian gem and given it leprosy. Dim streets behind blind taverns down by dead riverside, vortices of other worlds open in trash yards, nameless creeks, where crows and seagulls, Manichaean scavengers, discover your obligatory corpse. Or jelly from outer space, Indians still living in exactly the same places since 1706, sagging wooden row houses on dead-end streets, blocked by Route 9 and its ersatz modern sieve, its franchises and high-rises and honky-tonk take-home Chinese.
You're listening to Peter Lamborn Wilson reading from his book Hoodoo Metaphysics, which I recorded this past summer at the poet's home in Saugerties. For a long time, I've been making recordings of poets, and I'm quite fortunate to have a venue such as WGXC to present them. This month's program marks my fourth year anniversary as a programmer at WGXC, an organization I am extremely proud to be part of. I'm inspired by the efforts of my fellow programmers and truly believe in the importance of community radio as a means to know what's going on, as well as for many other reasons. We reflect the variety that is life. Naturally, I am a sustaining member and feel good about that, and as I know this is money well spent, I'm sure you will have the same sensation about it, so please do go and visit wgxc.org/donate and help us as you can. Now back to Peter Wilson reading from Hoodoo Metaphysics.
Part 3. Poughkeepsie Rural Cemetery. Exquisite example of Freemasonic-inspired 19th century rural cemetery movement, meant as reform against old, crowded, insalubrious urban church graveyards. Usually interfaith and initially very profitable, these bucolic paradises of death were landscaped with painfully sentimental, picturesque hills, dales, surprises, ha-has, little forests, lakes, islands, carriageways, monuments, separated by class, of course, winding paths amidst clusters of obelisks, catafalques, vaults, and tiny chapels of grace with stained glass windows by top Victorian masters. Cemeteries like this can exercise a kind of vertigo or superstitious frisson when you're all alone there on rainy winter weekday. Gates close at 4:30, says the sign. Are we lost? What if we got locked in? Zig and zag past Chinese rock formations and classical semi-nude angels, leaning life-size on black vaults, round and round the fake parkscape, down to the river and the railroad tracks, up to the highest peak and the white tomb tower of some fascist chief. On and on it goes, creating its own space-time dimension. Note the exquisite High Victorian Gatekeeper's Lodge as you make your grateful escape at last, back from Masonic illusion to the all-too-post-human industrial suburbs of Po-Town. Part 4. The Thing from the 13th Dimension. One minute, black anarchy. The next, black reaction. And I suppose the last, bleak despair. Comes with a side of French. Call it night. They intersect with your subconsciousness, which you've primed, as with black powder, for maximum Egyptian lotus sweet air perfume and special candles. Blue, blue, blue is the new black, manured, plowed, seeded, weeded for the growth of an entire oneiromantic industry to take the place of our rust belt ruins down by the polluted river between abandoned tracks, once the realm of shoes, cigars, whale oil, shad roe, and pianos. Shipped by sloop from Brooklyn's anti-memory zones. Forget the 21st century. Drift on romantic clouds above peaks of clouds. Blue as lapis lazuli from war-torn Afghanistan. Cheaper than heroin and twice as addictive. Each epiphany comes with a winning number, so the habit soon pays for itself. Sublime politics of dream. Could it be worse than reality? And what's so great about reality, anyway? Our guru, Fu, demands that we help each other realize our lost dreams in the mystic workshop, Syndicat des Rêves, a tesseract or four-dimensional Neoplatonic unsolid. Who wrote the missing books of Moses? The grand apotheosis of Egypto-Masonic ritual magic with grimoires, angelic alphabets, serpent on a stick, African gris-gris, bat's blood ink under the control of Black Hawk, the Indio head, the Apache Baphomet, John the Conqueror, Mexican sugar and Cuban marzipan. Who, if not Fu? Maybe 1923, maybe Chicago? Meet Mecca, Jerusalem of hobo blues, mojos and law stay away powder, based on graveyard dirt, mail order Mohammedans, divine doctors, gesture of connivance, complicity with the low-down rose nature of being its pluckability. Fu Futam's mystic union of universal brotherhood in the workshop of pure dreams somewhere on the waterfront in Eldrich Newburgh or sad early 19th century Poughkeepsie, faded, flunked little river cities, their historical centers peeling away on welfare and Episcopalian soup, would have recognized the Po-Town railway station as the true center of the universe. Textured with rotten frottage like Max Ernst's fungal Indian cemeteries long ago, effaced by red brick warehouse or badly haunted church, offering Anglo-Catholic rites, Society of Elks Hall with life-size bronze statue of Art Nouveau elk, Greek temple, sagging termite, infected white paint flaking 1860s, Veves, runes of the hanged man, spray-painted across the railroad trestle, worn at the end has already taken place. Cults of dreamers drift, haunt the ruins. Piranesi gypsies sleep, walk across silent night, dowsing for dream spoor, dream trash, to sift through like feral foxes, bears, grown bold, addicted to garbage, a parade of noctambules, eyes closed in white nightshirts. Silent demo of sleepers carrying black signs, but la vida es un sueño anyway, pullulating with demons and orgone, came up the river with all the Mexican farm workers. Duende, Day of the Dead, the new superstitions. We need to launch a jihad against the banal, a war on acedia, ennui, neo-bourgeois culture of D and O oppression. Occupy Dream Street. Love of nature isn't enough. We need fear of nature. Ice giants, volcanic orishas, fear of offending the duende. When people visit wilderness, they should tremble with awe. Photography will have to cease, or rather go back, revert to earlier iconogasms, magic lantern shows. Athanasius Kircher's silhouette, as if civilization could collapse, just back down to, say, 1795, and stop there. Nanotechnology. Samuel B. Morse of Poughkeepsie, failed painter, thief of patents, owns 1,800 acres down to the Hudson just for his summer cottage. We don't want your brass cable, yet somehow nostalgic for telegrams, strips of words cut out and pasted on paper delivered by Hermes. History's great advantage is to not be the present, but of course, that's also the reason for its failure. We cannot live in it. The antiquarian cares very little for history as what really happened. In any case, an epistemological swamp. But a great deal for poetic facts, for the élan vital, or vril, to be found in a given fragment of the past, a tactical retreat from fact, from datum, the fated, the always already, retreat from the idol of information itself with a gesture of refusal that would simultaneously embrace the thrilling, willed ignorance necessary to contemplate any thaumaturgic action, that is, action, pure and simple. Politics of aesthetics with no apologies. Into the darkness, till the demands of the Bono gang have been fulfilled and the Grail comes back to Scotland. We must also have an architecture of dream, headquarters for our foo, a Manchu cavern of cinnabar and opal, an opium den in Limehouse in 1911, a concrete junk that sails the seven seas without cease, a gigantic galvanized metal hangar abandoned down by the riverbank, a row of late 18th century houses disguised in aluminum siding, each crooked window set at a different height, remnants of gingerbread, lots of patina like an antique cello. Church of the Twin Ray, painted on boarded up shop window with Egypto-mummy motifs. Your usual Weird Tales plotline. Traveling salesman in old hotel leaves manuscript of flirtation with demon cult, then disappears. Published by Arkham House. The Devil in Dutchess County. A real spine tingler on sulfuric pulp paper from sad sulfuric paper factory towns in eerie upstate burnt over river canal land of the industrial uncanny. An old dream book that flakes apart when you open it for the first time since 1923. Blue Lotus of the Nile. Tranquility. That's how we say hello and goodbye in our sect. Tranquility. Everything that exists was created for your pleasure. Even if you spend most of your life in despondency, you know deep down it's true. The real deal baby Jesus on his own pretending to be a mushroom in a golden cope. The question is, can you dissociate yourself enough? We call it lucid dream yoga. Trademark, patent pending, copyright 1948, ambulatory schizophrenia, a kind of zen where you have to use bad karma as energy source. moaning and mourning, handling serpents, drinking poison, religion of the poor, we call it, mother opium, and only opium. The derivatives are all alchemically flawed. You never get the full hypnagogic sensorama, the narrative brio, the full Mr. Fu experience of ivory pipe, crystal lamp, with anything but the real authentic black smoke, slice of crow, cause of the opium wars itself. Not the medicalized, falsified, 2D, ungolden form of shots or pills. Dali said, do it once. Once is enough. The true artist gets it. The liquefaction of dreams, hallucinations of language itself. You know it's important because it's illegal. Babylon threatened by herbs, the healers of nations. Tender poppy and elfish fungi. Naturally, they're forbidden. They're sacraments. Duh. Blood of the Lord in the form of light. Blood of the Lamb with seven eyes in Revelation. That's the text of the sermon preached by the eldritch minister exorcist of the mystic dream in chapter 5 in the chapel of the old stone church near the railroad station, now dwarfed by the bridge overpass on Route 9, followed in half unrepressed, half digested, salacious fancy in that puritanical tone of utter moral dismay by vile orgies worthy of the goddesses of ancient witchcraft. Flora, Diana, Persephone, all quite vague, or rather unspoken, because unspeakable. Let the reader do your work for you. The acneed adolescent in a world without television. Pulp is his mundus imaginalis. Ah, the power. Thinks Gutenberg of dreams to discover the real meaning of Egyptian hieroglyphs unknown to science. The tedious antiquarian annotates a diachronic depth of focus for our misgivings, Poughkeepsie of the spirits. Poltergeists haunt 1840s black girl, cured by Dr. Jacob Brink, the white witch doctor of Kingston, Andrew Jackson Davis, half Swedenborg, half Fourier, self-taught messiah from Po-Town, founded American spiritualism. Aleister Crowley pays a visit in 1918. Ku Klux Klan, silver shirts, wall of Manitou, psychic effluvia of dead millionaires, going back to the 1640s. Interviews with present-day Wappinger's Indians of Dutchess County. The whole back country interspersed with distorted time zones where roads stretch out forever on foggy, sleety nights. Hypnagogic tunnels arranged to intersect like Klein bottles in an n-dimensional rhizome or false labyrinth. At this point, A, the protag could meet, fall in love with member of cult, suddenly give up Protestant hysteria, join the sect, find romance, live happily, quote, ever after, unquote, the story suddenly morphing from pastiche horror tale to crypto-utopian screed. Or B, the usual ghastly, unspeakable denouement, involving full gamut of authors' sick fancies about revenge on those who attempt to pierce character armor with invitations to the next pig out at the phalanstery. But which plot resolution is esoteric, Bottini, and which is simply exoteric, Zahiri, and worthy only of shit-kicking mullah bigots, the dreamer in his-her split consciousness? Am I walking on this castle parapet while still asleep? Or Is it a dream, etc., etc.? Cannot say. And this very state of vagueness acts as holy protection for the dream, or sometimes anyway an amulet to prove our incubation of dreams here in the temple of the 13th and final Jesus of Poughkeepsie.
Again, you are listening to Poet Radio on WGXC, Radio for Open Ears. I'm Chris Funkhauser, host of the program. Here during our fall pledge drive, encouraging you to become a sustaining member of the station, which you can do via wgxc.org/donate. As a station, we aim to be informative and intelligent and provide types of programming that you are unlikely to hear elsewhere. If you're uncomfortable using the computer as a donation mechanism, our phones work too. You can call 518-697-7400 to make your donation. You can even contribute in person at the WGXC Hudson Studio if you want. We do hope to hear from you one way or another, and we'll appreciate your support. Okay, back to Poet Radio. Here's Peter Lamborn Wilson reading the final section of Poe Town.
Part 5, Larval Cities. We wear the minor cities of our childhood beneath our clothes and skins, brown scapulars, theosophical auras made up of essential sadness, like the faded tattoos on an ancient mariner's arm. Wandering inland, but never far from rivers, with tides or canals, quicksilver, nervous, system of the early 1800s, all over New Netherland, once the whale oil capital of New Jersey. Moby Dick invades Rip Van Winkle land, overgrown with a rash of Victorian death cult landscaping and architecture. Parks, houses, horse carriages, shop windows, churches, all designed like ebony coffins on altars of jet upon obsidian plinths of fresh pallid marble, chill as church, set with shimmering crystal, hung with black velvet tassels, lacquered plaster, Gothic furbelows, horsehair ottomans for quick swoons. For example, New Brunswick, before Johnson & Johnson housemanized it. Ruins of vast red brick factories along dying Raritan River and Delaware Canal, black slums and warrens of disintegrating 18th century sagging wooden backstreets of woe. The Episcopal Church, fine faux medieval, with boys' choir and green graveyard memories. Mounted, jewel or horse, on an haute bourgeoise, Victorian sense of excess. Oedipal romance with maids' rooms in the mansard roofs. Brick chimney pots to spew coke fumes, blended with horse and primitive sewage. Whale oil, neat's foot, rock oil, leather, wet wood. Satanic mill, old-time pre-chemical pollution. Lingering on beneath the modern cracking tower superhighway asphyxiation, rotten, fishy, Dagon on the half shell, seagulls hover over the moribund water. Then comes a certain winter light, just before evening, a weeping thaw. Ground mist mingles with deflated cloud, making gree-gree gray a certain curtain that opens on duende, the way sorcerers see the world, behind the rain that doesn't quite fall, in the viva la muerte arms of melancholic foliage, tangled black as puritanical Spanish moss, backlit by the blind opal sky. Landscape of ominous ancestors for whom the city has become 100% Egyptian. First, you must escape it and lead a life of adventure and danger, and then, years later, return and indulge in the sadness, not yet leached of its authentic sadness, by any melting away into mere representation. Sadness of the Volk, tainted but saturated with poor sadness in its very degradation and mauvaise conscience. It was fake to begin with, but time has made it real. And the same goes for Newburgh, New York, and Poughkeepsie, and I'd say Hudson, too, with its whale oil, neo-Nantucket, Chestnut Hill row houses with bow windows, like musical instruments to live in, surrounded by other people's misery, and former whorehouses, and our official sad railroad train moaning over its pseudo-Rhinish post-Wagnerian Hudson line, the run-down Riverport Rondout in Kingston, or Saugerties, or Catskill, might have had this ineffable, I keep wanting to say, eldritch attraction, but they've been partly trendified and artisticated, like Beacon, now the art capital of Mid-Hudson Valley. They have their charms, but aren't really wabi in a beautiful way, an Irish way, a Japanese way. Poor beauty rather than pure beauty, unconscious of itself and yet aware of what must be snatched like candy or fruit by gutter snipe. Stop, thief! Each time with an entirely new experimental casting of spells, exorcisms, deployment of the goblinesque. The Tao of Bruegel. Grotesque feasts and couplings. Luminous spit in the face of a jealous OT deity. Bent on erasing Epicurean pantagruelism and legalizing usury. Here's where drunkenness comes in. Blasted on Guinness and Keef, even a perfectly empty night can be alchemized as divine waste because of the bleak landscape, the hallucinatory great grand city, Charles Adams' menhirs of justified sinners, so our Thelemite burglaries and saucergies, our wretched excesses, are at least pleasant memories against the social Darwinian future. An empty parking lot for your next 6,000 years of usura and survival of the shittest. To dream of the revenue officer denotes, by the rule of variable or paradoxical opposition, money in a heap from no matter what sources, says Dr. Fu. Free money from luck or gambling should always be spent on luxuries to enjoy as the gods enjoy in Book One, De Rerum Natura, without a shadow of fear. Drunk. North Dublin had this quality, an Eden of stout black sorrow, lit only by a goblin's lamp or two, scattered here and there like the last fireflies of summer. You pass through the old stomachs of these towns on the railroad, and from your window peep into windows of the squalid picturesque, a superior grade of fucking reality, a tune on a tin whistle by the very devil. Blow the whole thing in a weekend. Getting rid of money, an art form in itself, intoxicated even with virtue, unhomely, meaning uncanny, the backbone vibration and bristle of invisible Paleolithic fur, the taste of momentary aesthetic catastrophes at eventide. Providence, Rhode Island has neighborhoods we might add to this mini atlas of tristesse. Didn't the master live there, and before him the first master, Poe, with his oddly Chinese name, Poe Town or Poetry Town, as Ed Sanders would say, tidewater 18th century towns that have not yet become images of themselves and are honestly unpopular with the average tourist. ectoplasm gathers in railway stations of a certain era, feeds on ancient cigar smoke, barely lingers on undead aesthetes travel thousands of miles to see the way the plasm changes afternoon light, thick but astringent like spoiled white wine, undulant with worms of spirit life, thus the dreams of old cities.
That was Peter Lamborn Wilson reading Poetown from his very recent volume, Hoodoo Metaphysics. And before I turn to play you a recording of my interview with Wilson, let me remind you, you are listening to WGXC, and this is Poet Radio. I'm Chris Funkhauser, host of the program since 2015. I'm proud to be a programmer at such a fine station full of stimulating programs, and just as proud to be a sustaining supporter. And as this is our fall fund drive, we're hoping you will consider becoming a sustaining supporter as well. It's our goal to acquire 50 new sustaining supporters over the next 2 weeks. And if you can help us reach that objective, that'd be terrific. You do this by going over to wgxe.org/donate. It's an easy process once you get there. Okay, returning now to content. After my recording session with Peter Lamborn Wilson, I asked him a few questions about his work, and here's that. Well, thanks for reading the poems, Peter. Maybe we can start by talking about Poetown poem, dated 2012. So in 2012, were you living in New Paltz?
I'm not sure whether I was still there or in Woodstock.
But what year?
I moved from the city in 99, and I stayed in New Paltz until I moved to Woodstock in around that time. But I think I wrote all that poetry in New Paltz. I remember writing it in New Paltz.
So was it that you were just drawn to Poughkeepsie because of it, all the things listed and mentioned in the poems? I mean, and what was the connection with Ira Cohen there?
I don't know. He had died. He had nothing particular to do with Poughkeepsie.
I think Poughkeepsie is more or less across the river from New Paltz, right? Is that
sort of, yeah, more or less.
So
yeah.
You would go down there and just got...
Well, Poughkeepsie is a beautiful town. It has beautiful things in it. People don't realize that. They think it's an ugly, dirty old town. Everything else in Dutchess County is rich and millionaire-ish, Poughkeepsie is somehow proletarian and depressed. But if you look at the buildings in Poughkeepsie, you see the ghost of a former prosperous Victorian small industrial county capital with neoclassical government buildings and high Victorian domestic architecture and abandoned red brick factories, which themselves have some architectural quality that we now see.
Right.
The cemetery that I described is gorgeous.
Right.
It's full of amazing things, and I didn't see any tourists in the cemetery. In fact, I don't see any tourists in Poughkeepsie.
I guess
some people go there to eat. There's some, they know that there's some decent restaurants there, but nobody goes to look at these buildings, as far as I can tell.
No, that's right.
And I worry about them, that they'll, when they get some money, they'll tear them down and build neo-brutalist, boxes.
Like everything else.
Yeah, and it'll become like everywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I as a resident of Dutchess County, I don't have a negative view of Poughkeepsie, but as big as it is, it doesn't have a huge draw.
Doesn't seem to. Yeah. I mean, there's Vassar, which, by the way, is also architecturally exquisite,
right?
I think.
And then they've opened up the walkway across the river, which for someone who likes to do that sort of thing is pretty.
Walk across the river, but do they then go into Poughkeepsie and look at the Victorian architecture? And
doubtful.
I don't think Americans in general are not fond of Victorian architecture. I look at architecture magazines, I never see any features on you know, the amusing Victorian buildings of such and such a place.
Well, you were talking also in that poem a little bit about Hudson. Hudson has, but then when you turn to Hudson, you have this whole other take.
Hudson
on
is unique, of course. It has that architecture which is transplanted from New Bedford.
Right.
If you go to New Bedford, and I guess Gloucester, I'm not sure about that, but New Bedford for sure has those skinny houses with the bow windows that I guess reminded them of whaling ships or something. I don't know what it was.
That's right.
But when they came to Hudson, they brought that with them. And, you know, the Starbucks, the real Starbucks, were one of the founding families of Hudson.
Is that right?
Yes, yeah. It is. And a lot of those other ones whose names pop up in Melville. And when I first went to Hudson, I started asking people in the street. I said, "Where's the Whaling Museum?" And they said, "The what?" You know.
Right. Well, you go there and there's whales on all the street
whales
signs.
Whales on the little street signs.
Not good-looking whales either, kind of corny.
No, and there's no Whaling Museum, and there's no memory of the whaling. There's a book about the whorehouses of Hudson.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
But there's no book about the whaling of Hudson.
And you're not going to take that on as one of your books?
If I had settled in Hudson, I almost certainly would have.
Right, right. Well, that's an idea for the listeners out there. There's a book to be written.
Some patriotic citizen of Hudson.
But they have that incredible, like, psychedelic Victorian house on the hill above the Rip Van Winkle Bridge, a Frederick Church house. I mean, that's a Victorian. But
yeah, absolutely. That's one of the great great houses of America, actually.
But it's so weird. I mean,
yes, it's very strange. You know, we had other strange mansions. Some of them are still here. There's a castle that was brought over brick by brick from Europe. Do you know that building?
Is that the Bannerman Castle?
No, the Bannerman Castle is a fake castle, which itself has a certain charm. Bannerman was a self-made millionaire who somehow got hold of an immense warehouse full of war material, guns and
that's
bombs
right,
and
right.
stuff. And he sold it. He dealt that stuff, and he made a lot of money. He bought Popplepell Island, changed it to his own name, Bannerman. And he was a Sir Walter Scott fan when he was a child, as were so many people. And he decided he wanted a Scottish castle. He was going to become a Scottish laird on his own island. So that castle is built out of rebar and concrete.
Yeah, I've been.
It's totally fake.
Yeah. But I don't know about this other castle you're talking about.
As the guide said when I went through, he said it's only held together by the poison ivy at this point.
Oh, you're talking about Bannerman?
Yeah, Bannerman. But there's another castle, and I don't remember the name of it or where it is. I saw it when I was a kid. The story of that was this millionaire got married, and his wife said she wanted to live in a castle. So he went over to Europe, and he bought a castle. He had it disassembled. He had a number painted on each one of the stones, and he shipped them all to the Hudson Valley, and he reassembled them. And he had gotten as far as reassembling the shell of the building when she died. And he gave up. And it's a kind of sad and haunted place. As far as I know, it's still there. But there was a poured concrete octagonal building, one of the first major octagonal buildings, which was also in Dutchess County, that disappeared. I think it fell down, actually, sadly. I've seen pictures of it. It looked like a wedding cake, a six-sided wedding cake. Was all, you know, covered with Victorian gingerbread. It was a fabulous looking building.
In the earlier poems you read, you were the Foo is the character who is the author of these little books.
Well, one book anyway.
One book. But what is the connection between Foo and Poughkeepsie? Because I know Foo comes
well,
into
there's,
that.
See, there's another Foo in my life, which you wouldn't know from the poem. I mentioned him in passing. He was the proprietor of an opium den in Calcutta, Mr. Foo.
So there's some slippage between the two?
Yeah.
All right, that's good. F-U also meaning having a third meaning.
Well, that's true.
But I didn't. I mean, which I was thought of, but I disregarded as a legitimate.
I didn't
thought.
Even think of that.
No, no. Well, I'm American. What can I?
So I don't know. I had just recently written all the Foo poems, and I was writing the Poughkeepsie poem, and I thought I'd work. As it turns out, we now know her into the story.
Right. And did Crowley really make a road trip to Poughkeepsie, and what did he do there?
Oh, in 1918, Aleister Crowley came up to the Hudson River with a canoe and a tent, and he asked around for a place where he could camp, and they told him about an island in the Hudson called Esopus Island.
That's right. This is in your book, The River
yes,
People.
Yes, yes. I've written a chapter on this in my book, River People.
That's right.
It's true. It's all true. It's in his memoirs, which you can read. And he camped out for the summer of 1918 on Esopus Island. I went there. I made a pilgrimage there.
That's right. And he left his initials carved in the stone
well,
or something.
Well, that's, yeah, we don't... That's, yeah, maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
Right, right.
That's a structure called the Indian Cave, which is actually on the West Bank. It's not on the island.
Right. Well, it's so interesting to me that, you know, you travel around the world when you're younger, and then you more or less settle into New York City, and then at a certain point, as 20 years ago now, you leave the city, come up here, and in addition to all the other books that you write and are writing, you focus on
Well, when
places.
I moved up here, I decided I would see every hamlet and every body of water in Ulster County, and I intended to write a poem about all the bodies of water, from the Hudson River down to the more or less semi-permanent mud puddles.
Yeah.
You know, the vernal ponds. You know what a vernal pond
sure.
is, right? That was my ambition. Needless to say, I didn't get very far with it.
Right.
But I did write a lot of poems about water, and I lived next to the Wallkill.
Oh, the Wallkill.
And in Woodstock, I also had the luck to live next to a little creek.
That's right. Yeah.
And now I don't live next to water, and I miss it. I miss it terribly. I mean, I know that the river's just down the hill, but I can't see it.
It's a steep hill.
It's a steep hill, yeah.
Okay, breaking in here one last time to remind listeners that this is WGXC's Fall Fund Drive, and encourage you to make a donation so that we can keep this fine station in strong standing on the FM airwaves. Volunteer programmers here, such as myself and so many others, go to great lengths to provide skillful and knowledgeable radio all year round. Occasionally, we have to ask our listeners for donations, and now is that time. Please pay a visit to wgxc.org/donate and give anything you can. We vow to keep our high-quality programming going. Okay, let's now return to my conversation with Peter Lamborn Wilson as we conclude this month's program. I know you're constantly busy with writing projects, so what has captured your attention and imagination at this point?
Well, I have another book of poems from my huge pile of poetry that mostly got written in New Paltz and edited in Woodstock. And there are two books have come out from that pile, and there's a third one. So that's one. Another one that just came out is called The American Revolution as a Gigantic Real Estate Scam and Other Lost Found Essays in History. There's
excellent.
2, 4, 6. There's 6 long essays in the book. The title essay is The American Revolution is a Gigantic Real Estate Scam. And this comes from my...
a murderous real estate scam to boot.
Oh, yeah. Well, a war.
Right.
This comes from my season last year that I devoted to the Mohawk Valley, which, of course, is not in Ulster County anymore. So I needed something new. I felt that I'd kind of done Ulster County. But a friend of mine... And I started researching in Ulster County the question of the loyalists in the American Revolution, simply because they're understudied. Of course, historians have devoted a number of books to the so-called loyalists, but generally it's not a popular subject. And the approach to the American Revolution from most historians is still trumpeting triumphalism. How wonderful it was, how perfect it was, how America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, and everything about the revolution was all on one side. The heroism was all on one side. The right was all on one side. I mean, the correctness was all on one side. And the loyalists were wicked, aristocratic, no good, slimy, British traitors.
And greedy.
Oh, yes, and greedy. And, you know, the reality of the situation is a little more complicated, shall we say?
Yeah, at least.
And that's one of the things that my essay deals with. The other thing that it deals with is the Mohawk Valley story, which I became quite fascinated with, which was the military and diplomatic entente between the Iroquois Confederation and the Loyalists, and the British, I should say, the British forces, which were represented by Loyalists. And there was one extremely interesting person named Joseph Brand. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He was the Iroquois war chief, Mohawk war chief, and a great leader of guerrilla operations against the American forces. In effect, he won every battle, but he lost the war. He was an amazing tactician.
But this is different than the Calico Indian.
Well, I bring them in, but I bring them into the article because the white loyalists who joined Joseph Brand's little army, which was never more than 600 or 700 people at its largest extent, used to dress as Mohawk Indians or as Indians. I don't think it's because they had to or that they were trying to pass themselves off as Indians. It's something they did, I think, to show solidarity. I mean, you know, they were not literate people. They didn't write books. None of these people wrote books. Joseph Brand was probably the most literate one of them. And he wrote some letters, which are quite fascinating. But none of them wrote books. And we don't have their side of the story. We don't know why they dressed as Mohawks. Did they do it to terrify their enemies? Because the Mohawks had the reputation of ferocious warriors. So maybe they were trying to pass themselves off as Mohawks and make people, or just show by dressing as Mohawks that they were going to behave like Mohawks. That is to say, you know, fierce warriors. Who knows? But the fact of the matter is, a generation later, in the same area where these people came from, the tenant farmers who rebelled against the landlords dressed as Indians.
So that was before.
And in my article, I suggest that the reason for that is that they were the grandchildren of Joseph Brand's white Indians. The same people. It was the same family. I can't prove this.
Right, but it's coincidence. I could
devote the rest of my life to going through the archives, looking for family names, you know,
right.
Trying to prove that the Calico Indians were the actual grandchildren of people who had fought with Joseph Brand. I'm not going to do that.
No,
I'll leave that for somebody who wants to get a PhD out of this.
Is this book you're working on it now? Or is
no,
it
it's out. It just came out.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen it yet. That's cool. Who's the publisher?
Otana Media.
Oh, well, brilliant then.
My loyal publisher in Brooklyn.
Well, thank goodness for Otana Media.
Yeah.
Well, I think they did, though. I learned about the Calico Indians, I think, from the one, was it Gonda Crotan? Did they, was that their publication?
Yeah, I think we had an article in that book about them. Yes, that was Autonomy Media. The standard work on it is called Tin Horns and Calico by a guy named Chrisman. And still the best book on the subject. It was published in the 40s.
Very good.
They have not received a lot of serious historical attention.
Right.
Because they're poor people. The poor in America generally don't get the attention of the historians. It's the bourgeoisie who gets the attention. I've noticed.
Yes, yes. Well, one day that could flip, but...
Well, it is flipping, and there is a whole school, of course, of history from below and, you know, history of the working class and so forth and so on. But it's still very much a minority thing, I think.
Hmm. Great. Well, it's great to hear your poems, and I was thinking just yesterday that it's been 30 years since I met you. It was 30 years ago this month that we first met, and Peter and I met in... at Boulder, at the Naropa then Institute. Peter was inspiring to me because I handed him a cassette tape that I had just produced, and he said, "This is great, seize the media." And it was funny because I was just playing around with making a poetry magazine on audio. I wasn't, didn't take it to that level of I don't know, practice yet in my mind, but it was very, very useful, Peter. And it's been great to do these recordings now. And for those of you who haven't aren't aware of it, Peter and I recorded 600 pages of his poems 4 years ago in Woodstock, and that is available on Penn Sound. Any more poetry forthcoming? Or
one last book from the collection,
but not writing. You're not writing
poetry? I'm not writing poetry right now. You know, the Irish used to say that in order to be a poet, you had to live next to running water, to flowing water. And I suddenly realized that when I lived next to the Wallkill, I wrote like 7 poems a day. When I lived next to the little stream in Woodstock, I edited all those hundreds of pages. And now that I don't live near running water, I'm not writing poetry. Is that coincidence? I don't know. You tell me.
Hmm. Well, when you were, I didn't remember you as a poet when you were living in New York, but you lived kind of near the river.
I could, from 7th Street, I could just barely see the East River sometimes.
But were you writing poems then? I knew you, I knew of all of your essays and, you know, your prose.
No, I had a period of writing poetry. It was, when I left the city, I said to myself, now is the time to write, either to write poetry or to take up watercolors.
Huh. And you do
something, you know, countrified.
Uh-huh. Gentle.
Genteel.
But you you do visual.
And I did
collages.
Take up, and I did take, not watercolors, but
collage works and whatnot.
Yeah, I do a little art up here.
Well, who knows? Maybe you'll end up by a sitting by a stream like Tu Fu or
whatever, yeah.
All right, great. Well, a pleasure, Peter.
Okay, thanks.